Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Alison McMillan. Alison is an engineering manager at GitHub and one of the hosts of the Parent Driven Development podcast. Alison has worn many hats, including startup founder, community builder at the University of Michigan, or managing director of a national nonprofit. Alison is also a mother of two young children and very outspoken about the problems, especially new mothers face that want to stay in tech and progress in their career. So I'm super thrilled to have her on the podcast today to be able to pick her brain about how it is to work for GitHub and how she managed to have such a thriving career while at the same time taking care of two little ones. So Alison, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, really great. So Alison, maybe let's start from the beginning. So I said you're a mother, you're working for GitHub, you have this podcast. So how did it all start?
So how it all started. Well, I was actually working in the nonprofit world and decided to learn how to code. And so I took a Rails Girls, the first Rails Girls workshop that was offered in Washington, D.C. Took a Rails Girls workshop. I actually didn't expect to really enjoy it, but at the end of the day, I loved it. And I'm lucky that DC is a really just awesome, inclusive community, really welcoming of folks who want to learn. And it was just really friendly. And so from there, I continued to learn, became a software developer. And when I had my first child, which was a number of years before I started working at GitHub, it was a really tough transition for me. And I found that it was really hard to find outlets, to find people to talk to, especially mothers, but just parents in general. It was just really challenging. So I set up a little bit of a support network for myself just via Twitter and nice people who agreed to talk me through some of the hard stuff that I was going through. And I was there for a little while, and then I moved on to a different job, which was really great in terms of work-life balance and a lot of folks that had young children. And then a little while ago, I was before I had my second, I was just sort of thinking about new opportunities, thinking about options. And had a chat with a friend who worked at GitHub, and she said there is an engineering manager position open, and had just really, really great conversations with the folks that were there. And that's how I ended up there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, very cool. So actually, you don't have a traditional background, I get from your story. So you're somehow switched careers and started programming after you did something else before, or how does that work?
Yeah, I was a political science major. Mm-hmm. I was political science and Near East history. So nothing to do with code or even remotely related to sort of tech, et cetera. And I worked in the nonprofit world for a number of years. And then I launched a startup that I ran for a little over a year. And as I was working with a few friends who were developers, just in terms of what the MVP would look like, et cetera, I found myself getting really frustrated at not knowing like some of the constraints and some of the parameters. And I also felt like, you know, if I was going to start this tech startup, you know, based on an online platform, I really had to understand more about what programming was. I mean, at that time, I didn't even know that the command line was a thing that existed. And so again, Rails Girls was sort of just, I had a friend who from like the startup, from the DC tech startup scene, that was running the first Rails Girls workshop, and it looked interesting. And like I said, I actually expected to hate it. I sort of grew up in a very traditional household where the expectation and the message was that, like, really, as a woman, I wasn't, math and science like wasn't my thing, and I was never really very good at math and science in school. So I expected to not enjoy any part of the day. I was like, I'm going to go because I need to go, because this way I'll have a background and I'll be able to have better conversations with the folks that I'm working with. And at the end of the day, I mean, I had something, like I had something deployed to Heroku, and it was, you know, a little like to-do list app, and it was so exciting. And I had, you know, come across some error message and fixed some bugs. And I was like, oh, this is so much more interesting than I originally anticipated. And so I just sort of kept teaching myself, doing tutorials, you know, spun up my first sort of practice site, which is just a place to put meal and recipe ideas for my partner and I. And like I said, I mean, DC is really awesome. There was a lot of co-working. There's a lot of co-working that happens. So like I would, you know, do co-working before the DC Rug or Arlington Ruby event. And tons of folks were, you know, volunteered to read over my code and give me some feedback or talk to me about, you know, I mean, I remember sitting in a coffee shop and someone saying like, oh, have you heard of testing yet? Do you know what testing is? And I was like, I have no idea. And so they just talked me through like, well, this is what testing is and this is what the goals are and here are some examples. And then they like wrote my first test with me, just really, really kind individuals that gave me both confidence and a place to start from.
Oh, that sounds really inspiring, I think. What a really good story. So, and then when you, well, expecting your second child and you thinking career change is now the right thing to do, how did that whole thing start? So how did you approach GitHub? You said that a friend told you about that position and you were thinking already that you would like to change now. And when you started, how was that? How was that being a new mother and then starting as a new place, new work, new environment? I can imagine that's quite a lot. I mean, when I got my second child, I was like all hands. I needed all hands on deck just at home, you know.
Yeah. Well, actually, my first programming job was just before my first child. So I actually, because GitHub's been the third or fourth company I've mm-hmm. worked at in tech. I guess fourth if you include a place that I was at that I was a contractor at for a while. But third sort of full-time gig. I actually got my first full-time developer job right around when my husband and I were sort of thinking about starting to try for our first child. And we actually got very lucky and got pregnant pretty quickly, which was great, but it also meant that basically like 2 months into my first ever engineering role, I also had to tell the team that I was pregnant. At that time, I was working at General Assembly. There were a couple of other parents on the team, but no moms. There were no other women on the team at the time. So it was definitely scary. And it was, I mean, fortunately, it was remote, which I think helped a lot. But yeah, it was very difficult. And that was some of my struggles after my first, was that it was just really, I spent a lot of hours learning and teaching myself and putting time in and doing a lot of stuff before I had a child. And I wasn't expecting my brain to change in interesting, unanticipated ways. I wasn't expecting the prolonged like sleep deprivation. I wasn't expecting just like the less amount of time that I had outside of work to work on things. So yeah, it is really difficult to be a new mom, whether it's your first or second or whatever, and also be basically to have an infant and also be new to programming.
Yeah. Yeah. I also remember I had brain fog for, I think, 6 months or something after my first child. And I was like,
yeah.
Wow, I cannot think straight, right?
One of the most interesting things, because as I mentioned, like it was really hard to find people, especially mothers, to talk to. And I had one conversation with someone. Basically, I put out a tweet and I was like, I don't know if I should stay in the industry or just leave. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm having a tough time. I would love to talk to mothers who are programmers who can just talk to me about sort of what I'm going through. And I had one conversation with a mom who talked to me about the ways in which your brain actually changes. Because one of the things that really made me nervous was that I found that all of the techniques and all of the things that I had done in the past to learn things and to remember things and to like ramp up, a lot of them like weren't working anymore. And I was sort of freaking out about like, I mean, in, you know, at one time I was like, oh God, what if I can never learn anything again for the rest of my life?
yeah.
But one of the conversations that I had with mom talked about just like your brain chemistry changing and how sometimes like things just sort of move or like as a result of pregnancy and having a baby, like things change in your brain. And so sometimes your go-to methods or the things that you have been leaning on to learn or some of the processes that you've had in the future, like you really have to break those down and revisit them and figure out like, okay, what new thing works? What are some things that you can try? What are some different approaches so that you can figure out like in this new world, essentially, like what sticks now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in my experience, for me, it was a temporary thing, but because you don't know how long that phase will be, it's super scary.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I had brain fog and I was in this really strange state 6 months after birth, I think, where really hard to remember or to concentrate, to focus. But it changed afterwards. It changed. And I would say I'm almost normal again. Like, you know, 4 years after, I'm almost normal. but yeah, I have never heard of the chemistry changing, but surely with the hormones and everything, it does, right? So
yeah.
And so now you are an engineering manager. You're actually a manager of managers, right?
Yes.
At GitHub. So mm-hmm. What's your role there? Can you tell me a little bit about that? What's your day-to-day work? What do you do?
Yeah, so I run a department, an engineering department that's focused on communication and collaboration. So it's a variety of teams that focuses on different features and different things that we work on related to communication and collaboration. My day-to-day is a variety of things. Sometimes I'm meeting with the other department heads in my org. I do a few skip levels every week. I do a lot of one-on-ones and I do a lot of just, I try every day to sort of like roll through one of the teams that are in my department, which sort of means I just like, you know, get a sense of like what they're talking about, what major like technical problems they're solving right now, what are the things that are most important to them, both sort of like in terms of team dynamics, as well as like relating to other teams, collaborating across GitHub with other engineering teams. And yeah, and a lot of it is getting a sense of like where there are blockers and what I can help unstick or help solve or help listen about. So I would say my days vary, but that's a good amount of it.
So when you say you're having meetings with them, is that face to face or is that virtual? Because GitHub is quite a remote company. Is it completely remote or is it partly remote?
Not completely. We are, I think we're like between 60 and 70% remote. Okay. So there's a headquarters in San Francisco, and then there are a few smaller offices around the world. But most people are remote.
And what about your teams? Are they remote or are they also
partly remote and partly at the headquarters or at different locations?
They're partly the two managers and like a small handful of engineers on those teams work at headquarters, but a lot of them are, and even because we're such a remote company, like even folks that technically work from headquarters often do, you know, work from home days, or they're in the office a little bit and out of the office a lot. Cause it's like, you know, if you're in the office, but the whole rest of your team is remote, then like, are you really in the office? Like what, you know? So yeah. So people, I think, pick, even if they are close to an office, they sort of pick what works well for them. And so all of our processes, like everything that we do is done, I think, with like a remote mindset.
Okay. But you are completely remote, right?
Yes.
So when you try to, you know, get a feeling of what is everybody doing and how are they communicating, what are your go-to strategies for making that remote work? Because it's harder. I mean, in my experience, it's harder than if you're at an office. You just have to have more processes around, more strategies, and over-communicate a little bit. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, the first few weeks was definitely a lot about watching Slack to just get a sense of like how teams interact with each other. Like what's the vibe? You know, having a lot of one-on-one conversations to get a sense of, you know, different sort of like body language or things like that. We do a lot of video, like all of our meetings are video meetings. And so it's really helpful just to get a sense of like how chatty different individuals are or not, so that you sort of have a baseline, so that then you can tell when something feels like it's off, or when you feel like, you know, it's good to send a check-in message for, you know, for some reason. It's also paying attention to a lot of the little things. So, you know, somebody might say like, oh, I'm feeling really tired tonight, or like, oh, I had a kid who's sick, or a kid who was up, you know, for a few hours, or like, oh, this really exciting thing happened this week. So it's paying attention to those things as well. And then in terms of checking in on things, each of the managers that work for me and manage their teams, they all have cadences that they've set up with their team. So some teams use like Geekbot or some other sort of way to just to do sort of like a virtual stand up and just like mention in Slack, like, you know, what they worked on yesterday, what they're working on today. They're also like, they'll often have some sort of weekly sync meeting. And so, you know, I will either try to like jump into those just to be a fly on the wall, or, you know, read any notes or anything afterwards. And I think a lot of it is having a good amount of trust. So like, I trust that the folks that I manage are going to raise any issues or any concerns with me in our weekly one-on-ones. And, you know, I think that like, I have to trust them, they have to trust me. Like, I think it's really hard to have a remote culture when you're worrying about, you know, oh, if there is an issue or a question, like are they going to bring that up to me, or, you know, is this team really working, or, you know, those sorts of things. It's really hard to establish. Mostly it's really hard for other folks to get into a good sort of flow when they feel like they have to answer your questions all the time.
So I think that probably starts already with the hiring process. So when you're looking for people to join, especially a remote team, you probably look at specific mindsets and also qualities of people where you know they will strive in a remote environment. Would you agree? And if so, what would you look for?
Yeah, definitely. And I think so communication is big. One of the things that's really interesting to look for is how do people recognize situations and figure out what an appropriate response is, right? So how do they, if there's a conversation that's happening in Slack and there's a lot of people involved, or it's getting confusing, or like it seems like it's getting a little like heated, right? How does that person know? And so sometimes we'll ask questions about, you know, situations where you had a conflict with someone and, you know, and how you resolved it. And especially in a remote culture, right? Sometimes it's like pinging the person directly or saying in a group chat, like, hey, I actually think this topic is, you know, bigger and I'm going to write up at GitHub, we use like issues and repos, et cetera, for everything. So something mm-hmm. like, I'm going to write up an issue that captures everyone's thoughts and, you know, everyone please comment on it within the next 24 hours, because we also try, sometimes synchronous meetings are good, but also when you're working across a lot of different time zones, it's not fair for people in like the edge case time zones to always have to be accommodating like everyone else's time zone. So we try to do things like, you know, oh, we'll write up an issue, or like, I'm going to plan a time later this week that we can all sort of like, that we can, you know, meet via video call to, you know, to talk about this synchronously. And how that moves forward really depends on the team, right? It depends on the team. It depends how long the team has been working together. It depends sort of like what they're most comfortable with. But I would say in terms of interviewing, definitely asking about conflict resolution, you know, how just in general, like how they communicate, how do you communicate when you're stuck or when you need help, right? Things like that.
Yeah, so I was talking with Life Singer from Automatic, and Automatic is a completely remote company. And for example, what they do is they write everything down. There is, well, a WordPress site, obviously, for everything that they would do. So every project that they do, or every team has their own, you know, instance of a blog, and then they write everything down there. So you can always go and look at those written down conversations and find your way through that. Do you have something similar at GitHub?
Yeah, we use a lot of issues and repos. So every team has its own repo, and sometimes it's like where the code is, and sometimes it's more a repo for like internal team questions or documentations or things like that, that sort of document like how we work, onboarding, those sorts of things. We also make pretty liberal use of issues and a lot of labels on those issues, so that it's really easy to search for something and to find it if you're looking for, you know, not just sort of like bugs, features, et cetera, but also if you're looking for like weekly sync notes or stand-up notes or, you know, anything like that. And then the other thing that we use a lot is team discussions. So on GitHub, you can have teams, and oftentimes those discussion boards are sort of used for, you know, like you'll post information about the week or about what was accomplished, or, you know, something that's like really important for your team to know. And those are often published for the whole company, and the whole company doesn't get notified when they're published. But like, if I ever wanted to look at what was going on in a different team, like if something came up and I was curious about whether a different team would be interested in collaborating on something, that's a good place to look. Or Slack. We use a lot of Slack. We have a lot of channels, and it's not uncommon for somebody to sort of pop into another team Slack channel and be like, you know, hey, we're thinking about this idea. Would you be interested in being CC'd on the issue or being part of that conversation, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that triggered the thing that you said before about conflict resolution and communication is code reviews. I immediately had to think about code reviews, because I think code reviews resemble similar issues where you have like written communication, and, you know, topics can get a little bit heated. And one of the strategies to resolve that is also going out of this code review mode via, for example, tooling or, you know, via GitHub or whatnot, and having one-on-one conversations, either, you know, pick up the phone or, you know, call somebody or walk over and discuss it in person or write the document or, you know, take one step back and say, okay, seems, you know, there is more disconnect here. Let's revisit the whole topic or architecture or what the discussion is about. So I would like to know, how are code reviews seen at GitHub? How do you do code reviews? Is every team doing code reviews? And as you are the manager of managers, you probably have insights in different teams. Do you see differences, similarities? I would like to know everything about that.
Yeah, I think there's no one uniform way that we do code reviews at GitHub. I think one of the really nice things about GitHub is that there's very little that's actually like prescribed as you must do something this way. Managers are really given flexibility to sort of like work with their teams and figure out based on the project, based on the size of the team, based on, you know, a ton of different, like based on the geographic distribution, et cetera. There's a lot of leeway to say like this works for us, so we're going to do it this way or not do it this way, et cetera. I would say that in general, code reviews definitely happen. You know, I think that there are a few sort of basic, I don't want to say rules, but cultural practices that are followed. I think one of the most important things in code reviews is kindness, right? Thinking about, I think that when people do code reviews, at least from what I've seen, they really think about how things are phrased or how to suggest options, as opposed to using words like you should or if you just, you know, things like that. Sometimes doing a code review is actually part of our interview process.
Okay, interesting.
It's actually one of my favorite things to do as part of it. Personally, it's my personal take, not like GitHub stance, but it is one of my favorite things to do as part of a hiring process, because mm-hmm. I think that you can tell so much about, especially at a remote company where a lot of the interaction is going to be through code reviews. You can tell so much about a candidate by how they review a pull request. Because I think that, for example, like confidence is a huge aspect of being able to do good work with other folks remotely. So, you know, if you have someone on your team that's constantly reviewing code with really like, why didn't you do this? Or you should have just done this. Or if you had simply done this, like if the phrasing mm-hmm. isn't sort of kind and thoughtful, then it's also really easy to say to yourself, like, oh, I'm just such a bad programmer. Like, what am I even doing here? You know, whereas different sort of language or prompts that can be used. I think one of the, this is like sort of code review, but sort of not code review. Two other things related are we talk a lot about pull request descriptions. Mm-hmm. And so what is a good pull request? Like if, you know, for someone to be able to review your code effectively, what does a good PR look like, right? So a GIF, if there's functionality involved, if it's something complex, really making sure to sort of break it down and to spend time on that pull request description, right? What are you talking about? Why are you talking about it? What are other options that were considered, but that, you know, you didn't go down that path, or maybe went down that path and then reverted and tried something new? Like what is important context for either anyone who's jumping in to review the code for them to know, or even for future you to know about? Like mm-hmm. what I found is that pull requests with good descriptions often get revisited time and time again when you're looking for like, oh, how did that relate to this other team? Or, you know, what was that piece that we pulled in or the approach there? So I think that's really important. And then the other thing that's a little bit more related to like pull requests, but a little bit code review related, is that in our department Slack channel. I have a like a Slack bot message that posts on Fridays that asks people to post an interesting pull request that they authored or read and what was interesting about it or what they learned as a result. So that's a way to sort of like take code review or take the work that you're doing or that the work where you code reviewed somebody else and just sort of showcase it to a broader audience to say like, oh, I was so impressed by this, or I, you know, like this was a really interesting approach and I learned about this thing, or even highlight a code review conversation, right? It's a great place to say like, oh, this conversation happened via code review. Like the approach was really thoughtful and really excellent. And I really appreciated the conversation that occurred as a result.
Yeah, so much that you just described resonates very much with me. And while I give, for example, code review workshops, and one of the things is the feedback that I always go through with the people, because I think it's so important, it's so crucial how you phrase, as you said, how you phrase the feedback. And it's just very different if you demand something or if you ask a question, and it should be a sincere question, right? A genuine question. And not, you know, that you just package it into, I actually want to say you must, but yeah. I make a question out of it, question mark at the end. I think people can, even though it's written conversation, people can feel where you're coming from. And it's the same. What's really important is that it's about the code. It's not about the person, right? So for example, instead of saying, well, you have to close the socket, you say this code doesn't close the socket, right? It's a very different conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you said, in the studies that we did at Microsoft, we saw the same thing, that if you have a very good description of your change description, that's just saving so much time, and not even time, but also the feedback value that you get back from that is quite different, right? So if you don't have a lot of description there, or not a good description, it's really about the quality, right? Not the length. But if you have a good description of your changes, the people can understand what's actually going on and help you much better and give much better feedback. So that's really, really important.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I love that you pick PRs and look through them, because that's also one of the things that I always suggest, is to make a review of your review from time to time, right? Really look into how are we actually giving reviews? What are we learning? Where are we stuck maybe also, right? Where are bottlenecks, things like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I really like that idea of highlighting how you learn through code reviews, right? Because it's one of the really good side effects, if not even outcome, right? The primary goal of code reviews is that you're actually learning something and that you're communicating with each other.
Yeah.
I love that. So what about testing? Can you tell me a little bit about testing at GitHub? Do you have like automated tests? Do you have like manual testing as well going on? And how, you know, what's your philosophy behind testing?
Yeah, we have a lot of automated tests, and writing tests is definitely a very important part of being sort of a conscientious developer, making sure that, you know, you're also testing the code that you're writing, the feature that you're building, et cetera. Some teams have manual testing as well. It really sort of depends on how complex the product is. And what that looks like. But I think in terms of testing, we sort of follow like mostly standard best practices. I don't know if there's anything that we do that's particularly like unique or out of the ordinary, other than tests are good and they should be written.
And do you know, for example, for every change that you have, or even, you know, every pull request, do you have like, for example, suggestions or guidelines around that every pull request should have a test with it, or a test suite? Or is there some coverage, for example, criteria that engineers must adhere to, or something like that?
Like I said, at GitHub, there are very few like musts. It's not a hard requirement that everything that's like every single PR must have a test, because that isn't always necessarily the case or necessary. But if it's new functionality, if it's changing functionality, if there is, there are always tests that are run, right? So the expectation is that like there are tests that cover that change. And if there is functionality that's changing or being introduced, et cetera, then there are tests that should be included in that. And if the person, I think this is rare, but if for some reason the person doesn't include a test in the original PR, I think it's guaranteed that somebody in a code review will comment on either suggestions around a test or comments around a test, etc.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you actually learned Rails, so Ruby on Rails, right?
Yes.
Is that also what's fueling GitHub? Can you tell me a little bit about the tech stack behind? I think I remember that Ruby is one of the criteria, but is there more? What do you have to know if you want to apply for GitHub, for example?
Yeah, it's a lot of Ruby and Rails. There is also some Go, and I think there's more and more Go sort of popping up. And then there are also some teams that focus primarily on JavaScript and React and have a lot of no Ruby and Rails and more React, React Go, that sort of stack.
How would the hiring process look like?
The hiring process differs a little bit sort of team by team or department by department. But generally there's an initial call with a talent partner. And then we do a few interviews. There is usually a technical component where you're doing some sort of technical interview. Oftentimes that's a short take home, but it can take other forms. And then there's usually some, again, video call technical portion where it's active conversation. There is a values or leadership principles section where we talk about what our GitHub values are and ask questions around that. There's always an interview or a chat with the hiring manager. So the person that is related to the team that you would be joining. And then we also do a diversity, inclusion, and belonging interview. And there are folks at the company who get special training to be on that interview rotation. And that those are questions around how aware are you of sort of like diversity and inclusion? How do you think about diversity, inclusion, and belonging, et cetera, so that we make sure that the folks that are joining GitHub care about those sorts of things.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. Because GitHub is remote, or a large part, as you said, is remote, is it only US remote or is it worldwide remote?
It's worldwide remote, although we can't hire in every country or even every state in the US. So I know that on our job site, I believe there's a link that talks about where we can hire. I don't know all of the locations off the top of my head, but yeah, there are some restrictions in terms of where we can actually hire folks from.
But it's not only US, it's also Europe and...
Yes, definitely not.
South America and...
Yeah, Australia.
Asia, probably. Mm-hmm. Okay, very cool. So I know that you are quite a remote advocate and that you like the remote work.
I do.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you see that it's enabling for you, right? So you choose a remote workplace and you told me that even before working at GitHub, you also worked already remote. Why are you choosing that work style and what are the benefits that you see?
Yeah, I have been working remotely for I think around 8 years now. And even before when I was working in the nonprofit world, the organization that I was at, we started all co-located in an office in Washington, D.C., and as the organization grew, we recognized the benefits of having folks around – at that point, it was just around the country, around the United States – and we recognized the benefit of having folks around the U.S. And so one of the things that I set up there was actually our first set of remote staff. And by the time I left, we were about 50% remote, 50% in person. And – for me, part of that was also making sure that the folks that were co-located in the office were taking work from home days, were taking just days where they were not in the office, so that they got a sense of what it was like to be remote, what some of the pain points were, et cetera. It led to just better team collaboration and communication, et cetera. I love working remotely. There are a number of reasons. I mean, first, I think that it enables me to do a lot of – it enables me to pack a lot of different things into my day. So I have two young kids. I don't always get to shower in the morning. It's nice that I work remotely and can sort of, you know, add that into my day whenever. It's nice that I can go to my fridge and eat leftovers or snacks or whatnot for lunch. I think that I save a lot of money by not sort of eating out. And then, I mean, also on the money side of things, with childcare, when you have to add in commute time to the number of hours that you need to pay childcare professionals or daycare or whatnot, it can add up really, really, really quickly. Because obviously, if you're working 40 hours a week and you have a commute or something, whoever is taking care of your child or children is working more than 40 hours a week. And so there's overtime, there's all sorts of additional complexity that goes into it. I also think one thing that I love about working remotely is that I get to work from a variety of different places. So in DC, for example, all of the Smithsonian museums they're free for entry. They all also have internet. They all have wireless. And so, you know, I'll work from the Portrait Gallery, or I'll work from the Renwick or the Natural History Museum. Like, if I feel like going down, like downtown into DC, there are just a lot of really cool places and spaces that I can work from. And I find that on days where I'm less motivated, or I'm working on something that's a little bit more abstract, and I just need like open spaces or inspiration, or I don't know what it is. Like, I love being able to like walk around completely different places and then just sort of like sit down on a bench and jot some notes down or things like that. Taking breaks to take a walk during the day. I mean, there are a lot of things. I also, with two young kids, it's nice because I can organize my day like how it makes sense. So I have my usual working hours, but if for some reason my son has something going on at preschool, we're moving a little slower in the morning and therefore drop off takes a little longer, instead of having to like get really frustrated with my kids and be like, out the door, we need to get out the door, out the door. It's like, okay, well, like, I'm going to start my day 20, 30 minutes late. But, you know, in the evening after they're asleep, I can always like open up my computer and read a few emails or catch up on anything that I feel like I need to catch up on, et cetera. So it's nice. The converse of that is that when you work at a company that with people around the world, somebody is always, it's always work, it's always regular business hours for someone. So you really need to be very disciplined in like turning off notifications or closing your computer and saying, I am separating myself from my workday. I am not working. I will not work until this time or until, because it's really easy to just like at 8:30 when my kids are asleep, it's sometimes really easy for me to just like open up my computer because I'm doing some other personal stuff, get involved in a work conversation, end up like, you know, all of a sudden it's 10:30 or 11 p.m. and I realize that I've like accidentally worked for 2 hours instead of rested and relaxed.
Yeah, I can see so many things that you said. One of the things that I love the most is lunchtime. So my husband and I are both working remote and we always have lunch together. And I think that's one of the biggest things that why I love remote so much. It's just those, you know, 30 or 40 minutes that we just spend together and have lunch every day. And, you know, it's just our quiet time because you never know how it's going to be in the evening, yeah. When the kids have to go to sleep and things like that, right? So I really enjoy that very much. So, but remote work isn't, as you said, there are also, you know, obstacles, drawbacks, and things you just have to be aware of. What would you say, what are, you know, the best strategies to make it work? What are the obstacles we have to overcome, and what would you do about them? Yeah,
yeah, I think that one of the most important things is figuring out what your working style is. So is it enough to have, I do recommend like having some sort of dedicated space in your home that is your sort of office area, but is it an office? Do you really need to like get out of the house and co-work? For me, one of the really important things, so I wake up, I get dressed every day. That's really important to me in terms of like I am getting dressed and starting my work day. I cannot be productive in my pajamas. It's just like can't do it. I have a separate place that I go to. I also, especially in colder months, I make sure that I'm co-working with friends like at least once a week, because otherwise I've definitely had times in the past where like I'll just sort of randomly be in a little bit of a bad mood or something feels off and I like stop and think and I realize that I have not left the house for 5 days except to maybe do like pick up and drop off or, you know, something like that. So making sure that you sort of know yourself and are building those things into your schedule. One thing that I'm really bad at that I try always to be better at is I really need to be like getting out of my house more, not just co-working, but also like taking a break in the afternoon, because I feel like I get so focused on work and the things that I'm doing or meetings or whatever that it's hard for me to take a break and take a walk, et cetera. And I don't have any sort of built-in walking, active, et cetera time because of a commute. And so that's a thing that I'm always trying to get better at, right? Making sure that I'm having, establishing and maintaining a healthy lifestyle and healthy habits around working remotely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I also, when for example, if I'm not picking up my kid from kindergarten, then sometimes, as you said, I'm not leaving my house. Yeah. And I feel like that's really unhealthy. And if I go out of the door, it's like, wow, it's day, you know, it's sun is shining. It's wonderful. And it really boosts the mood. So I think we have to be considerate of that, that even if you don't have this commute, which I'm really happy that I don't have, but on the other hand, that, as you said, that you have some routines around going out of your house or, you know, doing something healthy for yourself. So Alison, we talked a lot. Before I let you go, I really want to pick your brain a little bit more about, you know, motherhood or parenthood and working, because I know that you spend quite a lot of time researching that topic and why is it so hard for like new mothers or new parents to be in tech or be in the workforce? So what are your go-to strategies to, you know, what would you suggest a young mother or a young father in their early days, you know, of parenthood?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's interesting because one of the things that I've found, so a couple of years ago, I put out this big survey. It's actually still my pinned tweet and Twitter, because I do a conference talk called Baby-Driven Development. And every time I do that, I've given it a handful of times over the last few years. Every time I do it, I go back to the research. I go back to my surveys and I update based on new survey results that have come in. And what's really interesting is that it gets a little easier as your kids get older, but a lot of the challenges still remain the same, right? Things like there are a lot of logistics about having kids. No matter how old children are, there are just so many logistics to who's taking care of them, different hours, how they're getting from one place to another, sick days, snow days. I mean, all sorts of stuff. So I think that one of the most important things, so one of the most interesting findings from the survey is the data around how men and women, or how mothers and fathers felt like having a child affected their career are very different. And I will say I also have options for like for non-binary on there, but I don't have enough data results to be able to include that into like into the statistics right now. But the number of mothers who feel like having a child has negatively affected their career is like 60 or a little over 60%, whereas for fathers, it's much lower. And I think that part of it is like is mental load, and that a lot of things it's expected that moms will take care of. One of the things that I always talk about to moms and dads about is recognizing what the parental workload is of each person, and not just like who's taking care of the child or who's cooking dinner, but like who's responding to emails, who's buying presents for birthday parties, who's making doctor's appointments, who's making sure kids' hair gets cut, right? There's like a million little things. And I think that a lot of that stuff often falls on mothers. So I think that's one really big thing. And then I think it's the other really big thing is that like your time outside of work is just limited. So being really intentional about your workday and focused about how you can hit a bunch of things while you're working, right? So what work do I do that is also fulfilling and also where I'm learning things, right? So that I don't have to learn a whole bunch of things outside of work. How can I look at what I'm doing at work and make sure that I'm getting opportunities or looking at stuff where I can be learning and advancing and growing through the course of my workday, as opposed to having to put in additional hours outside of work to feel like I'm getting that. And I think that that's like really a huge aspect of it.
Yeah, I like that very much. And I think it's changing your mindset, right? Because as you said, it's really hard outside of the work that you put in work than to do something else. I mean, there are the kids and you want to spend time with them and with your family. And it's just, you don't have the same opportunities that you had before. I mean, I always, you know, I traveled the world and it was so easy. And if there was a job opportunity in America and it was good enough, I was like, oh yeah, hell yes.
Sure, yeah,
I
mean, where's the plane? Yeah.
Where can I sign, you know? It doesn't matter. I find something. There are Airbnbs or whatnot, you know?
Yeah.
I have a friend. I will find friends, yeah. Right? It doesn't matter. And right now, I mean, even for job opportunities, I'm like, oh, sounds really amazing, but I can't do it. Or as you said, outside of work, if you want to do something in addition, right, you have to, for me, for example, a lot of what I do right now is I want to do what I really love for work so that I don't have to have another thing that I do that I really love, right? So you have to really work on combining the different forces that you have. And yeah, I like that. I like that advice a lot. Yeah.
And then, I mean, one other thing, especially working remotely, it's so easy to just work all the time when you're remote. Like, even, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I'm sick and I don't feel great, but I don't have to go anywhere. So I can just like, you know, I can work today, but I'll work it at a slower pace. One of the most important things for me has been taking off at least a day, if not like a couple of days, every few months that is like pure self-care time for myself. So a day where like, because you end up having to take off so many days for like school closings and illness, like for all these random things that are not actual like vacation days, because you have to take them off of work because you have a bunch of other responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So I make sure to just take off, you know, a day or a couple of days every here and there, that where like husband's at work, kids are in childcare, preschool, whatever, and it is literally just me and my day. And I also try to really force myself to not use that day to just like catch up on like various things around the house that have to get done, to like pick a show that I'm going to watch 5 episodes of on Netflix, or to like meet up with a friend for coffee, or, you know, just things like that remind me that I'm still a person outside of like being a mom and being a wife and being a, you know, employee of GitHub, et cetera, that like at the core, there is still a person that is me.
Yeah, I'm daydreaming right now, you know, imagining myself doing that. To be honest, that's on my plan. I never, my older son is now 4 and I haven't done that yet. I haven't had a one day off thing yet. But yeah, because if I have, as you said, I do something for work, which probably not the best thing, but yeah, I'm dreaming of that. One day I will do it, but I actually dream of doing it together with somebody. I'm so afraid of being lonely that I think that's the reason why I haven't done it yet, because I don't want to be lonely and everybody else is working, so what should I do? Yeah, but a good advice. Yeah, I like that, and I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, it's amazing. I feel like as parents, sometimes we don't even realize how tired we are until we do that. And then it's like, oh, wow, that was great. Like, I need to do that every, 'cause it was also, I mean, it was years before I started doing that. And then I was like, I wonder what it would be like to just like take a day. It was after my second, it was like, I wonder what it would be like to just like take a day where I'm not, you know, doing anything. And it was like, it was amazing. It's sort of like how, as a parent, when you're only getting 3 hours of sleep a night, and then one night you get like 5 hours of sleep, you feel like you can do anything because like you've gotten so much more sleep than you're used to getting. It's sort of like that. For most people, I feel like taking a day off would like not seem like it would make such a difference, but like for a parent, because for especially a full-time working parent, because we're like pushing ourselves so hard in so many different fronts, it really like is pretty incredible.
Yeah, actually, I'm a little bit afraid of it. I don't know why, but there's a little bit of a fear creeping in, you know, like if you talk about it, I'm like, yes, I should really do that. And on the other hand, there's like this fear. No, don't do that. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's there. Yeah. So, Alison, thank you so much for talking with me about so many different topics. Is there something that you want to tell my listeners, or that we haven't discussed? They definitely should check out your podcast, I
I was going to
guess.
say, can I do a shameless plug for
Yes, you
my
should.
podcast?
You should.
Yeah, Parent Driven Development is the name of the podcast, and parentdrivendevelopment.com or at Parent Driven Dev is where you can find us on the internet or on Twitter. It's really a nice sort of perspective on a variety of different parenting stages. So if you're listening, you should definitely check it out.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So thank you, Allison, for being on my show. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.